and 2. Break for roughly 15 minutes for each hour of work you do. This may seem like a lot of time across an 8-hour workday, but it's approximately equivalent to taking a 1-hour lunch break and a 15-minute break in the morning and afternoon. In most situations, these two rules are practical and can be carried out without affecting your work schedule. Why is 90 minutes the magic number? Our mental energy tends to oscillate in 90-minute waves. We sleep in 90-minute cycles, moving between periods of light, deep, and REM sleep. Our energy continues to follow the same rhythm after we wake. We feel rested for around 90 minutes and then tired for a short period of time, around 20 to 30 minutes. A short break every 90 minutes or so takes advantage of these natural peaks and valleys in energy cycles. Take a break when you notice your focus dipping or after finishing a big task. Doing so will mean you'll experience less attentional residue as you allow your mind to wander. By taking strategic breaks, we're able to use periods of greater mental energy for maximum productivity and replenish our energy when it would naturally dip. Research shows we're more creative during these low-energy periods, as during them, our brain is the least inhibited, which allows more ideas to rise to the surface. This makes low-energy moments perfect for scatter focus. Start to pay attention to the ebb and flow of your energy levels in the morning and make a concerted effort to step back when you feel your energy beginning to dip. Energy levels stabilize a bit more in the afternoon, as well as dip less predictably, but it's worth sticking with a similar rhythm. And why should we have a 15-minute break for each hour of work? There isn't a lot of reliable research on this subject, but one company did try to crunch the numbers. A time-tracking app called Desk Time, which automatically tracks the computer programs you have open so you can see at a day's end how productive you were, assessed the break data for the most productive 10% of their users. They discovered that, on average, these users took a 17-minute break after every 52 minutes of work. It's worth adapting your break schedule around your work habits. If you have a second tea or coffee in the morning, take it after 90 minutes of work and give your mind a legitimate rest during that time. Instead of eating a rushed lunch in front of your computer, take a real lunch break, one that will legitimately recharge you for the afternoon. Leave your phone at the office and enter scatter focus mode on a lunchtime run or while reading a good book, being sure to capture any thoughts and ideas you've been incubating. In the afternoon, grab a decaf coffee or take advantage of your company's nap room, meditation space, or gym. The best time to take a break is before you need to. Much as you're probably already dehydrated when you feel thirsty, your focus and productivity have likely already begun to falter by the time you feel fatigued. Sleep. Speaking of rest, it would be remiss of me to not discuss sleep. I personally have a, granted, somewhat pseudoscientific rule that I think is worth following when it comes to sleep. For every hour of sleep you miss, you lose 2 hours of productivity the next day. There is no scientific backing for this rule. As with breaks, we're all wired differently, but the amount of sleep we get matters a great deal, especially with regard to knowledge work. We lose more than we gain when we compromise our sleep to work longer hours. The size of our attentional space can shrink by as much as 60% as the result of a sleep deficit. Complex tasks can take more than twice as long when we're tired. We also become less self-aware and survey our attentional space less often. Working with a diminished attentional space is fine for mindless tasks like copying data into a spreadsheet, but our productivity is undercut when we try to focus on something complex. In most cases, we're better off working fewer hours and getting enough sleep than trying to do a full day's work while tired. Some people claim they're able to get by with less sleep than everyone else, but chances are either their work isn't as complex or they'd be capable of accomplishing even more if they were better rested. Even worse, the sleep deficit makes us perceive our productivity as being higher than it actually is. Even though we spend about a third of our life in a basically comatose state, we understand very little of what happens during this time. This is true for a number of reasons. Our brains are inordinately complex, brain scanning equipment is expensive, and the noise of the scanners tends to disrupt participants later and lighter stages of sleep. The studies that do provide a glimpse into what happens in our brains as we sleep, however, are fascinating, especially the ones that examine the similarities between sleep and scatter focus. If you were to place someone who is dreaming and another person who is daydreaming into a brain scanning machine, you'd notice something peculiar. The two brain scans would be eerily similar. Sleep dreaming and daydreaming in scatter focus mode activate the same brain regions, though they're even more active while we're asleep. On a neurological level, dreaming is scatter focus mode on steroids. This makes sense when we consider the two modes. We feel recharged after episodes of both sleep and scatter focus. Our minds wander to many of the same places, whether we're sleeping or daydreaming, including past regrets, fantasies and anxieties about the future, and our relationships with other people, though our mind jumps among things a lot more when we're dreaming. The mind has a chance to defragment its thoughts during both sleep and mind-wandering episodes, as well as to consolidate the information it's been learning and processing. The brain also fires somewhat randomly in each mode, which can lead to breakthrough ideas as well as some random useless material. It's no wonder countless great ideas have come to people in their sleep, including Paul McCartney's melody for Yesterday, Dmitri Mendeleev's idea for the periodic table of elements, and Jack Nicklaus's new and improved golf swing. In addition to the productivity toll, the costs of working with a sleep deficit are numerous. Research shows that as we get less sleep, we also feel more pressure at work, focus for a shorter duration of time, even less than 40 seconds, fire up social media sites more often, experience more negative moods, actively seek less demanding tasks, eliminating those that no longer fit into our shrunken attentional space, and spend more time online throughout the day. This holds especially true for those aged 19 to 29, a demographic that chooses to go to bed later than any other age cohort, around midnight on average. Given that most of us need around 8 hours of sleep, turning in at midnight doesn't exactly prepare us to be productive the following day unless we have the flexibility to wake up late. As a side note, one of the best ways to get more sleep and to increase the quality of your sleep is to develop a solid nighttime ritual. Because our energy levels are depleted by the end of the day, we tend to spend a large amount of time then on autopilot mode. Establish a set routine that enables you to unwind before bed. Consider adding habits like reading, meditation, disconnecting, drinking a cup of herbal tea, or simply removing the TV from your bedroom. It's a convenient object of attention, infinitely more stimulating than sleep. Getting to bed at a decent hour is the best way to get enough sleep. While most of us need to wake up by a certain time, our nightly routine is usually more flexible. Rest is not idleness. It often doesn't feel right to step back and rest when you have more work to do than time to do it. You may even feel twinges of guilt. This is usually just self-doubt rearing its ugly head. As you consider the opportunity costs of taking a break, you begin thinking of all the other things you should be working on instead. Taking a break feels less productive than getting real work done, so you feel at fault when you even consider stepping back. This logic doesn't hold water in practice. In fact, taking a break is one of the most productive things you can do. As we've discussed, your brain has a limited pool of energy, and once that reserve is depleted, so too are your focus and productivity. Brakes not only allow you to recharge, they prevent you from hitting a wall. Whenever we rest, we exchange our time for energy. This is true regardless of whether we're resting by taking a break or by getting a good night's sleep. This time investment doesn't evaporate into the ether, and in reality, you should feel guilty about not taking breaks. I've asked you to look back at your work and life quite often in this audiobook, such as suggesting that you think of when you felt the most focused and creative. There's a reason for this. You can learn a lot through a little introspection. If you want to become more productive, creative, or engaged with your work, the truth is you already have a huge amount of data at your disposal. All you have to do is reflect on when you were the most productive, creative, or happy, and consider the conditions that led to that state. It's worth doing a similar exercise here. Think back to when you last approached your work with the greatest energy. Maybe there was a stretch of time when you had a habit of exercising at lunch or took more breaks than usual. How much were you able to accomplish on those days? Taking more breaks will absolutely lead you to work smarter and accomplish more. Ironically, the busier you are, the more you need them. During times like this, the likelihood of being overwhelmed is higher, and you will benefit from the perspective scatter focus provides. This chapter is one of the shortest in the book because the main idea is simple. Scatter focus mode helps us recharge our ability to hyperfocus, in addition to letting us plan for the future and become more creative. Chapter 8, Connecting Dots. It's not that I'm so smart. It's just that I stay with problems longer. Albert Einstein. Becoming more creative. As well as enabling you to plan for the future and replenish your supply of mental energy, scatter focus allows you to become more creative. You can use scatter focus mode to become more creative in two ways. First, by connecting more dots, and second, by collecting more valuable dots, a topic that will be discussed in the next chapter. Hyperfocus is about focusing on a single thing. This lets your brain become productive, encode information and experiences so that you remember them later, and engage with the world around you. In scatter focus mode, you do the opposite. You zoom out and connect the constellations of dots in your head, a dot being any piece of information you hold in your mind. On a neurological level, our brain is a constellation of dot-filled networks, and we're constantly adding more with every new experience. We gather dots when we're creating memories with loved ones, studying history, or reading the biographies of people who lived through it, which helps us understand the sequences of ideas that created the world we live in today. We accumulate dots with each mistake we make and learn from, and each time we're open enough to admit that we're wrong, which replaces the obsolete dots in our mind with new ones. We harvest dots with each enlightening conversation, which permits us to gaze at the constellations of dots that live in the minds of knowledgeable people or ones who see the world differently. Each dot is encoded into our memory and available for later use. The word that best describes how your brain looks when you enter scatter focus mode is random. Scatter focus lights up your brain's default network, the network it returns to when you're not focused on something. This network is widely distributed across the brain, as is the information we've encoded into memory. One of the many reasons scatter focus leads to so many creative insights is that while we're in it, we naturally begin to connect the scattered dots we've collected. As we cast a metaphorical net across our minds, fishing for novel connections, we connect ideas while we rest and plan for the future. We're not always aware of the ideas our attentional space pans over as we move among our thoughts. Like an iceberg that resides mostly underwater, much of this process takes place in the depths of our consciousness. Since we can focus on just a small amount of information at one time, only a few of the active connections in our minds can break into our attentional space. However, these random connections do get our attention when they become sufficiently activated. It's at this moment that we realize we should hire Cheryl instead of Jim, map the intentions we should set for later, or arrive at a sudden eureka insight. Insight triggers. Uncompleted tasks and projects weigh more heavily on our minds than ones we finished. Focus comes when we close these distracting open loops. We're wired to remember what we're in the middle of more than what we've completed. In psychology circles, this phenomenon is called the Zagartnik effect, after Bluma Zagartnik, the first person to study this concept. The Zagartnik effect can be annoying when we're trying to focus, but the opposite is true when we scatter our attention. In fact, it leads to amazing insights into the problems we're incubating. Chances are you've experienced a few eureka moments yourself. Maybe they struck you while you were making breakfast, getting the mail, or walking through an art gallery. Your brain suddenly and unexpectedly found the solution to a problem you hadn't thought about for a few hours. In an instant, the puzzle pieces satisfyingly slid together and locked into place. Two things were likely true at that moment. First, at that moment, your insight was a response to a problem you were stuck on. Second, your mind was likely wandering while you were doing something that didn't require your full attention. Thanks to the Zagartnik effect, we store any and all problems currently stumping us at the front of our minds. Any open problem, an unfinished report, a decision we're in the middle of, or an important email we're responding to is an open loop that our brain is desperate to close. As a consequence, we connect each new experience to these unresolved problems in order to unearth novel solutions. Habitual scatter focus brings these connections into our attentional space. When we're in habitual scatter focus mode, potential insight triggers come from two places: our wandering minds themselves and the external environment. It's best to illustrate this with an example. Let's say I invite you to my secret productivity experiment lair. I offer you a seat, set a timer for 30 minutes, and ask you to solve this seemingly simple problem. The number 8,549,176,320 is probably the single most unique 10-digit number in the world. What makes it unlike any other number? Let's imagine you can't solve the problem in the allotted time. Not unreasonable, given that this is a particularly tricky one. You leave frustrated, and the question continues to weigh on your mind. What is so unusual about the number 8,549,176,320? By now, you've reached an impasse and have encoded the problem into memory. You've started to see those digits whenever you close your eyes. Naturally, the better you remember a complex problem, the greater your odds of coming up with a creative solution. This particular brain teaser would probably never actually cause a high level of torment, but for the sake of this example, let's say it does. Thanks to the Zagartnik effect, your mind will automatically connect your new experiences to this problem, whether you realize it or not. You return to work, still frustrated, with the number imprinted on your brain. You find your mind returning to it periodically, sometimes even against your will. In fact, odds are that your mind will wander more often than usual. Our thoughts drift more often when we're in the middle of solving a complex problem, which will cause you to make a higher than normal number of mistakes in your work. Later in the day, you work on an activity that takes you into habitual scatter focus mode, organizing your bookshelf in alphabetical order. You're putting away the book, The 80-20 Principle, by Richard Koch. As you do, your mind processes where the book will be shelved. Okay, ignore the word the. First value is 8, so I'll put that with the other books that start with that number. Huh, the number in Chris's experiment was also an 8. Like a lightning bolt, the solution hits you. You feel dozens of puzzle pieces sliding and locking into place in your mind. 8,549,176,320. 8, 5, 4, 9. A, B, C, D, 8, 5, 4, G, H. The number in Chris's experiment had every digit arranged in alphabetical order. As far as insight triggers go, this is a fairly straightforward one. Usually, they are more subtle, nudging your mind to think in a different direction and restructuring the mental dots that represent a problem. I designed this example to illustrate a simple concept. Habitual scatter focus lets our mind connect the problems we're tackling with what we experience, as well as where our minds happen to wander. Insight is a notoriously difficult subject to study. To do so, you have to lead people to an impasse on a problem and maintain sufficient interest in it to make them want to solve it later. Luckily, you don't need the results of research to support these findings. You probably have enough data at your disposal in the form of your own past experiences. I can't stress enough how remarkable insight triggers are. You may see a bird picking at a chip packet, which leads you to realize you should clear the chips you've been snacking on out of the kitchen so you can lose those final 10 pounds. Intentionally daydreaming during your morning shower, you recall how you resolved a past work dispute and realize you can use the same technique today. Walking through a bookstore, you notice a cookbook, which reminds you that you were planning on replacing your kitchenware set, and that there's a store around the corner that sells them. The richer our environment and the richer our experiences, the more insights we're able to unearth. Look back to some of the greatest eureka moments in history. In addition to reaching an impasse with their problems, the famous thinkers arrived at solutions to them after being spurred by an external cue. Archimedes figured out how to calculate the volume of an irregular object when he noticed his bathwater overflowing. Newton came up with his theory of gravity when he saw an apple fall from a tree, probably the best known insight trigger in history. For his habitual scatter focus routine, renowned physicist and Nobel laureate Richard Feynman would sip 7-Up at a topless bar where he could, quote, watch the entertainment and, if inspiration struck, scribble equations on cocktail napkins, end quote. Connecting even more dots. Simply entering habitual scatter focus mode will enable you to experience the remarkable benefits I've covered so far. But if you want to level up even further, here are 6 ways to do so. 1. Scatter your attention in a richer environment. Being mindful of and controlling your environment is one of the most productive steps you can take. In addition to creating a focused, conducive environment using the steps I discussed earlier, you can also help surface scatter focus insights by deliberately exposing yourself to new ones. Immersing yourself in a setting that contains potential insight triggers is a powerful practice. A rich environment is one where you're constantly encountering new people, ideas, and sights. Break activities like walking through a bookstore or people watching at a diner are far more valuable than those that don't carry any new potential cues. Adopt a mix of such activities, some that give your mind the space to wander and connect dots, and others that expose your mind to new ideas you can connect later. As a side note, you can also use cues to capture everything you need to get done. Walk around your house with a notepad and draw up a list of tasks that need to be completed. This list represents your external cues. You'll be able to capture just as much, if not more, valuable information if you do the same at the office or while browsing each folder on your computer. While this might feel overwhelming at first, you'll be able to better organize and prioritize everything on your plate. If you want to deepen your relationships with friends, scroll through the contacts app on your phone and take note of whom you haven't connected with in a while. If you want to develop deeper professional relationships, scroll through your LinkedIn contact list. Deliberately exposing yourself to new cues can help in these ways and more. 2. Write out the problems you're trying to crack. I hit a major impasse when I poured through the 25,000 words of research notes I had collected for Hyperfocus. How could I reorganize these digital scribbles into something that resembled a book? My outline document was essentially a 25,000-word problem statement. I printed and reviewed it regularly, noting at the top of the pages my biggest challenges, such as how I'd make the book practical, structure the manuscript, and present the research so that it was interesting. Regularly reviewing these problems and the document itself kept the project fresh in my mind. Frequently entering habitual scatter focus mode, including one afternoon during which I scanned the tables of contents of about 100 books to see how they were structured, surrounded me with potential solution cues. I was scattering my attention in a richer environment. Eventually, the answers came. Writing down the detailed problems you're tackling at work and at home helps your mind continue to practice them in the background. When you capture the tasks, projects, and other commitments on your plate, you're able to stop thinking about them and focus on your other work. The opposite is true when it comes to the problems you're in the middle of solving. Recording them on paper helps you to better clarify, process, and remember them. This same technique works for large projects, making an outline for how you'll write your thesis, remodel your kitchen, or staff your new team helps you process these ideas in the background so you can continue to collect and connect new dots related to the project. Another powerful idea for the smaller nuts you're trying to crack, in addition to setting 3 next day intentions at the end of the workday, note the largest problems you're in the middle of processing. You'll be surprised how many you figure out by the next morning. 3. Sleep on a problem. As I mentioned earlier, dreaming is scatter focus on steroids. While you're sleeping, your mind continues to connect dots. There are countless examples of eureka insights that have struck people as they dreamed. To harness the power of sleep, Thomas Edison would go to bed holding a handful of marbles, and Salvador Dali would doze off with a set of keys in his hand, dangling over a metal plate. Both men would continue holding the items during the lighter stages of sleep, but drop them once they hit a deeper stage, which woke them up. This allowed them to capture whatever insight was on their mind in that moment. Edison put it memorably when he purportedly urged that you should, quote, never go to sleep without a request to your subconscious, end quote. Deep and free-form connections come especially strongly as you dream during the REM stage of sleep. One study that had participants incubate a problem found that during REM sleep, participants, quote, showed enhanced integration of unassociated information, end quote, which helped them find a solution. Sleep also helps you remember more. It consolidates the dots you've accumulated over the course of the day into long-term memory, and intentionally forgets the less important and irrelevant dots you encountered. You absorb a lot of noise over the course of the day, and sleep gives your brain the chance to dispose of dots that don't have a valuable connection to the others in your mind. To invest in a good night's sleep, and to use this tool to your advantage, review the problems you're facing, as well as any information you're trying to encode into memory, before you head to bed. Your mind will continue processing these things while you rest. 4. Step back. If you followed the tactics in the first half of the audiobook, and especially if you've started to meditate, chances are the size of your attentional space has expanded. As this happens, it becomes increasingly important that you enter scatter focus mode in order to intentionally scatter your attention. Research suggests that the larger your attentional space, the more likely you are to continue stubbornly hammering away at complex tasks on which you're stuck. This is where scatter focus trounces hyperfocus. Scatter focus is much better at piecing together solutions to complex, non-linear problems. The better you're able to focus, the less prone you are to mind wandering, and the more important it is that you purposefully unfocus. It's also worth taking your time in solving the problems presented by creative tasks. Purposefully delaying creative decisions, as long as you don't face an impending deadline, lets you continue to make potentially more valuable connections. For example, the longer you wait before sending an important email response, the better and more articulate your reply is likely to be. The same is true for tasks like deciding between a few potential hires, brainstorming a revamped design for your company's logo, or outlining a course you're teaching. 5. Intentionally leave tasks unfinished. The more abruptly you stop working on a creative task, the more you'll think about it when you switch to another. Leave some residue in your attentional space for your mind to continue processing the initial task. For example, try stopping work on a complicated report midway through a sentence. Leaving tasks partially completed helps you keep them front of mind as you encounter external and internal solution cues. 6. Consume more valuable dots. We are what we consume. You can take deeper advantage of scatter focus mode when you become deliberate about the information you take in. Consuming new dots exposes a wealth of new information and triggers that you can use to solve complex problems. I've devoted the next chapter to exploring this idea. These dots have an enormous effect on what we focus on, can make or break our creativity and productivity, and are the lens through which we view the world. Chapter 9. Collecting dots. Clustering. Unresolved problems aren't the only things that sit at the front of our minds. All of the other dots we've accumulated matter just as much, if not more. This knowledge is what helps us become more creative in scatter focus mode. The more valuable the dots we collect, the more we have to connect. In practice, the dots we consume and connect are so important because our focus is always filtered through what we already know. Gazing at the ocean, a biologist might ponder all the creatures that lurk beneath its surface. An artist might consider the colors she'd use to paint it. A sailor might take note of the condition of the wind and the waves, while a writer might try to think about the words he'd use to describe it. People become experts on particular subjects by accumulating and connecting enough dots related to them, in the form of experiences, knowledge, and best practices. Our brains are naturally programmed to cluster related dots. As a simple example, think back to when you first learned to write. You likely began by learning the letters of the alphabet, how they were shaped, what they sounded like, and so on. These were the first dots you accumulated on the topic. At this point, your brain started connecting these dots, clustering them into alphabetical order, distinguishing the consonants from the vowels, and learning how to pronounce different syllables. You then began clustering these dots further to form words. To process the new ideas more deeply, you likely connected them to various pictures, as well as to objects in the world around you. After this point, you began clustering words and concepts together into phrases, sentences, and paragraphs. As you listen to this book, your knowledge of phrases, sentences, and paragraphs is so embedded in your mind that the act of listening has become implicit. You no longer have to think about these words. Reading is a compelling example of the power of collecting and connecting dots. By learning something new, you transfer dots from your external environment to your memory, so you can link them and make use of them later. From the moment you're born to the day you die, your brain is always engaged in this process. As we cluster more and more dots about a given topic, we naturally develop expertise, which in turn helps us better manage our attentional space. Curiously, the more we know about a subject, the less attentional space that information consumes. Recall that our attentional space can hold around 4 chunks of information at once. The more dots we're able to cluster, the more efficiently we're able to use that space, as we can accommodate and process a lot more pieces of information when they're linked together. We read more efficiently by processing words and sentences than by processing individual letters. An expert pianist can process all the elements of a piece of music, the melody, harmony, tempo, and so on, better than someone who has been playing for only a few weeks, which means she can make more efficient use of her attentional space and maybe even daydream while she plays. We do the same by collecting more dots related to our own work and investing in building relevant knowledge and skills. This lets us make more efficient use of our attentional space, whether we're using that accumulated information to hyper-focus on a task or piecing together new ideas in scatter focus mode. We can work with more expertise and creativity because we've already done the due diligence to cluster this information together. A footnote on this: if you've ever felt like a fraud or an imposter in your field, you're not alone. The next time you do, simply consider how many dots you've accumulated and connected about a given topic relative to everyone else. Chances are you understand the nuances and complexity of the topic just as much as whomever you're comparing yourself with. Working with more information at our disposal also helps us make more intuitive decisions because we're able to subconsciously summon pre-existing knowledge in our memories. This information prompts us to respond appropriately in a situation, even if we're not consciously aware that we're doing so. For example, during a conversation, we can intuit that a member of our team is upset and that there's something she's not telling us. We know this to be the case because we've experienced the same situation in the past and, on some level, remember the signs that indicated that she was unsettled. This is how intuition works. It's the process of acting upon information we remember but don't consciously retrieve. We are what we pay attention to, and almost nothing influences our productivity and creativity as much as the information we've consumed in the past. Accumulating many valuable dots helps us in innumerable ways. We become able to connect our challenges with the lessons we've learned. Our scatter focus episodes become more productive as we link valuable ideas, especially as we become more responsive to new insight triggers by exposing ourselves to new dots. And our hyperfocus episodes become more productive because we're able to make more efficient use of our attentional space, avoid mistakes, see opportunities for shortcuts, make better high-level decisions, and approach our work with more knowledge in hand. Through this lens, intelligence and creativity are very similar constructs. Both intelligence and creativity involve connecting dots, but in different ways. Intelligence involves connecting dots so we understand a given topic more intricately. Creativity also involves connecting dots, but in new and novel ways. Seen this way, intelligence and creativity aren't something we're born with. There's something we earn as we collect and connect enough dots about a given topic. The value of a dot. Just as there are limits to how well we're able to focus, the same can be said about how much information we can collect. While our brain has nearly limitless storage space, our attention is far more restricted. Getting information into our brain is akin to filling an Olympic-sized swimming pool with a garden hose. While we're able to hold a huge amount, we can fill it up only gradually. This makes it essential that we deliberately consume dots. No two pieces of information are created equal. Consuming a book or having an engaging conversation with someone smarter than you will enable you to collect more valuable dots than doing something like watching TV or reading a gossip magazine. This is not to say that consuming popular culture isn't fun. Life would suck without the occasional Netflix binge, and you'd probably get more than a little bored if you spend every spare minute reading dense books and academic journals. At the same time, it's worth auditing and increasing the quality of dots you consume regularly. The most creative and productive people defend their attentional space religiously, allowing only the most valuable dots to be encoded. So how do you measure the value of a dot? First, the most valuable dots are both useful and entertaining, like a TED Talk. Useful dots stay relevant for a long time and are also practical. Their entertainment value makes you more engaged as you consume them. While it's fairly easy to tell if something's entertaining, there are several ways to measure how useful it is. Useful information is typically actionable and helps you reach your goals. For example, listening to a few talking heads argue about political issues on TV probably isn't actionable or conducive to your personal goals. It also sucks up time that you'd otherwise spend consuming more important dots. Reading a science book or a biography about a historical figure is much more valuable. Works like these can inspire you with a new perspective, are relatively practical and non-speculative, and can help you reach your personal goals in the short and long term. The information they contain also has a longer shelf life. As well as being actionable and beneficial, useful dots are also either related to what you've consumed in the past or completely unrelated to what you already know. Consuming information adjacent to what you've taken in before allows you to develop a constellation of dots around a single idea. If you're a software engineer, taking a course to learn a new programming language or reading a book on managing engineers is obviously a productive use of your time, attention, and energy. Any piece of information that supports your existing skills is a good use of time. The more expansive your constellation of dots, the more valuable connections you're able to make. Your brain even releases more dopamine, a pleasure chemical, when you consume information that supports what you know. At the same time, it's also immensely valuable to consume dots that are unrelated to what you know. Taking in novel data gives you an opportunity to question whether you're consuming only information that confirms your existing beliefs, and it may provide an insight trigger. Again, your brain is attracted to and wired to remember novel information. If you're in doubt about consuming something, ask yourself, how do you think your life will be different knowing this piece of information? The tactics in this book are all intended to help you manage your attention deliberately. The same principle applies here. When your creativity is essentially the sum of the dots you connect, consuming information on autopilot mode is one of the least useful activities to engage in. Collecting more valuable dots. Picture a simple chart with usefulness of information labeled on the left vertical axis and entertainment value of information labeled on the bottom horizontal axis. Now, imagine a steep downward sloping line going from the top left to the bottom right. Generally speaking, practicality does not equal entertainment. This isn't always the case. You may, for example, find some series books more entertaining than reality TV shows, but most of what you consume will follow this trend. We can further separate the most useful things we consume from the least useful. In decreasing order of usefulness, there's information that's useful, balanced, entertaining, and finally, trashy. First, there are the useful dots we consume. This information is actionable, is accurate, helps us reach our goals, and remains relevant for a long time. It may also be related to what we already know, so it allows us to connect and cluster more valuable dots, or unrelated to what we know, leading to more serendipitous connections. For me, things like nonfiction books, online courses, and journal articles about productivity are in this category. Useful information is typically the densest of the three categories. Books are a good illustration. While a book can sometimes take less than 10 hours to read or listen to, it can take decades to write and may contain a lifetime of lessons that the author has learned and summarized. Books provide access to the highest quality thinking and most useful dots on pretty much any topic. Having an unlimited amount of energy to consume useful information throughout the day would be ideal, but this obviously isn't possible, even if we frequently replenish our supply of mental energy. However powerful our brains are as dot-connecting machines, consuming exclusively non-entertaining material can quickly become a chore. This is why it's also important to seek out balanced dots, information that is both useful and entertaining. Countless things fit into this category, including novels, podcasts, documentaries, and TED Talks. The entertainment value of this information makes it easier to become engrossed in it, and as a result, we're more likely to continue consuming it and become actively involved with the information it provides. Finally, there's the bottom third of what we consume. Information that's entertaining or, at worst, trashy. Though, like junk food, it can be fun to consume in the moment, this information is the least dense, isn't practical, and won't help you live your life or reach your goals. This category includes the TV shows we binge watch, the mindless books we read, and most social media websites. We usually consume this material passively on autopilot mode. While some of it is genuinely entertaining, the top 50% or so, the bottom half is trash information and is usually some combination of novel, pleasurable, and threatening characteristics that make it easy to crave. As a rule, we should consume more useful information, especially when we have the energy to process something more dense. Consume balanced information when we have less energy. Consume entertaining information with intention or when we're running low on energy and need to recharge. And consume less trashy information. There are two steps to upping the quality of information you collect. One, take stock of everything you consume. And two, intentionally consume more valuable information. As a side note, the purpose of consuming more valuable dots isn't to turn you into a Vulcan automaton who consumes only worthwhile information in your spare time. Where's the fun in that? The point is to let you step back from the information you do consume so you can determine with more intentionality what to take in. It's impossible to become more productive or creative without first reflecting on your work and life. This is what makes tactics like defining your most important tasks, setting intentions, and letting your mind wander so powerful. Defining your most valuable dots is just another one of these tactics. To begin your audit, assign everything that you consume to one of the four categories of information: useful, balanced, entertaining, and trashy. Include the apps you fire up automatically, the websites you routinely visit, the books you read in your spare time, the shows and movies you watch on TV and Netflix, and any other relevant information you take in. It can be helpful to carry a notepad for a few days to list everything you consume and, if you want, for how long you consume it. Do this at home and at work. If you consume a lot of books, courses, and other information for your job, it can be helpful to make two lists, one for the things you consume professionally and another for what you consume for personal benefit or pleasure. You'll likely notice immediately a few things you want to change. The amount of time you spend on social media apps, reading news websites, or watching TV. You may also find patterns that surprise you. For example, the average American consumes 34 hours of TV a week. If you're one of them, that's a lot of time you could be spending on more useful pursuits. You may also notice what you're lacking, such as the fact you don't read any fiction, even though you've always enjoyed it, or that it's been a while since you invested in learning a new hobby. Once you've taken stock, here are 10 ideas for how you can change your habits to intentionally consume more valuable information. Start by trying 2 or 3 that resonate particularly strongly with you. 1. Consume things you care about, especially when few others do. When listing the information you take in, you may have found you enjoy consuming things that other people tend to underappreciate or shy away from. Maybe you love taking coding courses in your spare time, an activity that may feel like a chore for most people. Or you love listening to audiobooks about productivity. I plead guilty to this one too. Double down on developing the skills and knowledge that you find entertaining. Also opt for the medium you prefer. If you learn best by listening, try consuming audiobooks instead of physical books. If you prefer visuals, try watching TED Talks instead of listening to an audiobook. 2. Eliminate some trash. Passively consuming pointless trash adds nothing to your life. Choose 2 items that don't bring you genuine enjoyment and eliminate them entirely. Look out for material that, while stimulating in the moment, doesn't leave you satisfied afterward. Be ruthless about defending your attention. Every time you stop consuming trash, you make room for something useful to add value to your life. 3. Choose a few valuable things to add. What useful books can you read, courses can you take, or conversations can you have that might prove valuable later? Can you consume more complex information about a certain topic to take your expertise to the next level? What about yourself have you been wanting to improve, or what have you been eager to know more about at work or at home? Add something valuable for each worthless thing you eliminate. Push yourself. The most valuable information you can consume is material that challenges you and usually requires your full attention. 4. Notice what you consume on autopilot mode. Pay special attention to what you pursue when you're low on energy or as you transition from one task to another. Often these objects of attention are just convenient and don't add much value to your life. When a friend you're dining with leaves the table for a few minutes, what apps do you mindlessly open on your phone? Do you reach for your phone as soon as you wake up? What sites do you visit when you're surfing the internet on autopilot? 5. Veg out intentionally. You're perfectly productive whenever you accomplish what you intend to. This is true whether your goal is to read a chapter of a textbook or to watch 4 episodes of Game of Thrones. If you're going to veg out, do so with intention. Set the criteria for what you plan to do, such as the number of episodes you'll get through, what you'll eat as you watch, what you'll do afterward, and so on. This not only allows you to act with intention, but also leaves you feeling less guilty so that you can actually enjoy yourself. 6. Reevaluate what you're consuming as you're consuming it. In addition to being more selective about what you consume, you should reevaluate content as you consume it, skipping or skimming anything that's not worth your time. The Zeigarnik effect makes us want to finish what we start. But every minute we spend on something useless is a minute we lose working on something useful. After you begin a book, movie, or TV series, assess along the way whether you should pursue it to the end. 7. Get things to bid for your attention. View the descriptions of podcasts, TV shows, movies, and books as a pitch for your time and attention. You don't have to listen to every podcast that automatically downloads, every show your DVR records, or every book a friend recommends. Deciding whether something merits your attention takes an extra step, but it's a decision that will save you hours you can then devote to something better. 8. In the moment, zoom out. Try zooming out to a larger time frame if you're having trouble deciding in the moment between a few different things to consume. If you spend any time on social media sites, you may be familiar with those oddly satisfying cooking videos that show an entire meal being made in half a minute. Spinach is reduced to 1/5 its size in a second, and small chunks of chicken cook in 2 seconds. You can zoom out on the material you're considering consuming in a similar way. Let's say you find yourself with an hour to spend however you want. Take an extra step to observe your life from afar. How would you want to see yourself occupying that time if it were sped up into a 30-second video? Would you want to see yourself lying like a blob on the couch watching Sherlock on Netflix or mindlessly tapping on your tablet? Or would you rather watch a video of yourself poring over 100 pages of a book? Zooming out to observe the impacts of your actions will nudge you to consume more valuable information. 9. Invest in serendipity. Consume challenging things outside the boundaries of your expertise, ones that force you to make more disparate connections. The more disparate the dots you connect, the more valuable the connections often end up being. Set your browser's homepage to open with Wikipedia's random article bookmark. Look through the AMA, Ask Me Anything section on Reddit, where world-renowned experts answer popular questions from everyday people. Go see a band you've never heard. Read a book on a topic you know nothing about. Take a class in a subject you've always been curious about, like quilting, dancing, or public speaking. Pick up a biography about a historical figure whose name you know, but whose life story you don't. I signed up for an online course on coding iPhone apps several months back. Today, it's one of my favorite things to do in my spare time. 10. Double down on what's valuable. There are some topics you know more about and some things you're better at than almost anyone in the world. The more dots you collect around these particular topics or skills, the more of an expert you'll become. For each worthless thing you eliminate, consider doubling down on something you're already good at or a subject you know a lot about. If you're a teacher, for example, instead of firing up Netflix on autopilot mode after work, consider taking a course to invest in new professional skills. When you double down on what you're already accomplished at, you'll be surprised by how much more productive and creative you become. Like magic. As we continue to assemble a constellation of dots around a certain topic, ideas begin to build upon one another. Eventually, ideas become magic. I love this quote from British science fiction writer Arthur C. Clarke, quote, "Any sufficiently advanced technology is indistinguishable from magic," end quote. I'd take this a step further to argue that any sufficiently complex decision or idea is also indistinguishable from magic. Whenever we don't understand the complex network of dots that contribute to some result, we ascribe it to magic or genius. I've had an obsession with magic tricks since I can remember, but I find figuring out the workings behind a complex illusion far more satisfying than seeing the trick itself. Illusions stop being magical the moment you discover how they're done. But learning how they're done feels like a eureka moment in and of itself, as a set of jumbled puzzle pieces locks into place. Like a magician's, the methods of a genius are mysterious until you untangle the web of connections that leads to them. These individuals usually have more experience, have put in more hours of deliberate practice, and, most important, have connected more dots than anyone else. As author Malcolm Gladwell wrote, quote, "Practice isn't the thing you do once you're good. It's the thing you do that makes you good. End quote. Albert Einstein was undoubtedly a genius. He connected more dots in more unique ways than almost any other human. At the same time, he was bound by the same mental limits that we all are. To conceive of an idea like the general theory of relativity,